This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So is June 21st in doubt after all? The latest news is from various government advisors and scientists saying that perhaps a delay of a few weeks would be a good idea. Katie, what's going on here? Because a few weeks ago we were hearing that there wasn't so much worry about the Indian variant.
Yes, it comes and goes. And I think we're now at a point where there's increased concern. We have a situation where the Prime Minister was busy getting married this bank holiday weekend, but scientists, meanwhile, quite busy getting on the airwaves warning about June 21st. And I think it's one of those things where actually the voices that have been dominating the past few days are some are, you know, official advisors to the government, though there are many scientific advisors. So I think you can advise the government and not be the main voice, if that makes sense. And I think initially, so we had a member of NervTag on Sunday suggesting that we could be in the beginning of a third wave of coronavirus in this country, and therefore it'd be wise to wait a few weeks to see the data before pushing ahead for June 21st. And then since then, I think, again, more voices coming out today from various organisations ultimately saying that the Indian variant is on the rise and therefore we need to be cautious and the government needs to learn from its past mistakes in terms of moving too quickly, because if you're not careful, you could end up in another lockdown. Now, where are we? I think that you always have to remember that the scientists are going to push harder on these things, and meanwhile, Tory MPs are clearly saying, oh, we have to press on completely. It's also, I think, a little bit of a negotiation. So you have both sides asking for various things, and where the government probably lands is somewhere closer to the middle. But I don't think we know where we are yet, because the government has said it's not going to make a decision until June 14th. I think a few weeks ago, there was, before the Indian variant really became on course to be the dominant strain, there was hope they could do a strong hint, at least perhaps even an announcement saying June 21st is going ahead several weeks before to give lots of places notice. That now seems very unlikely. I think we are much more likely going down to the wire on this. But the government will be getting data this week and next week, which is going to inform that decision. And actually, when you look at what the scientists are saying or what the government are saying, I don't think they're that far apart, in the sense that lots of scientists are ultimately saying that the most important thing is making sure all over 50s have two doses, and because that is much more effective when it comes to the Indian variant. The government is also briefing out, and this, I think this was the front of the Times and a few other papers over the weekend, that their plan is to offer all over 50s two doses before June 21st. So I think it is a race, and actually I think that there is still a desire from the Prime Minister and others to push ahead with the state, and actually it's about the speed by which he had the vaccine. There's also some promising data coming from Bolton, which was the hotbed for this, where the infection rate is falling. So ultimately we're not going to know for a while. We said that for several weeks on this podcast, but it's going to be about the data, and that is going to slowly come in.
And James, the Daily Telegraph today splashes on a call from health leaders from around the world that wealthy nations should be offering more of their vaccines to poorer countries in order to avoid situations like this where variants come about because a poorer country is still suffering in the depths of the pandemic. Do you think that call is going to be definitely on the agenda at the G7 later this week? And is it inevitable as a policy?
I think as the rich world vaccinates itself, it will become more interested in vaccinating the rest of the world. I mean, that is the kind of the brutal reality of it. I mean, there is an interesting debate about the most effective way to do this. So, for example, the US, which has had a kind of export ban until very recently on kind of everything involved in the production of vaccines, you know, it's talking about an intellectual property waiver. Various EU countries are not keen on that, arguing that essentially if you undermine intellectual property rights, you make it less likely you'll get a vaccine in the next pandemic. You've got the UK saying that its Oxford AstraZeneca model is what you should do. You know, you license it to anyone and the like. I think in reality, once the rich world has vaccinated itself, it will turn to the issue of donating vaccines to other countries so it can happen. I think you mentioned India, and obviously the situation in India has had a particular impact on the campaign to vaccinate developing countries, because lots of the COVAX manufacturing capability is in India. And India has imposed an export ban on vaccines because of its current predicament. So I think you will see this become a kind of bigger and bigger issue, especially because of this whole question of variants. Now, we can debate what border policies would work most effectively and the like. But I think the point is, I think it's very hard to keep a variant out completely while at the same time having anything approaching normality. I think on the June 21st question, I think as Katie said, you know, it is waiting for the data. And it is also the question, you know, I said in the magazine this week, you know, there's the question, you know, can you give two doses to everyone by the 21st? And how far in advance are you hitting that target? So are you confident those people have the maximum level of protection that reopening? And the other thing to remember is there are two very different types of June 21st. There's a June 21st with social distancing still in place, working from home still in place, mask wearing still in place in lots of places. Or there's a June 21st with no social distancing, masks only on public transport, and the government kind of leaving it up to people and businesses, whether people work from home or in the office or on the factory floor. I think in terms of what the government would like to get rid of, it is social distancing that is the priority, because it is very difficult for lots of pubs and restaurants to break even with social distancing in place.
And Katie, you mentioned earlier that the Prime Minister had a wedding over the weekend, and it was a secret wedding with even some number 10 staffers not knowing about it until the papers were reporting it. Can you tell us about what happened on Saturday?
Yes, so apparently long in the making, but we had a situation last week where I think it was the Sun that broke the story that there was going to be a big celebration of a wedding by Boris Johnson and Carrie Simmons, or Carrie Johnson these days, by next summer, so next July. And I think that is still on the cards, but the ceremony, and there was a little bit of grey area in how they phrased it, took place on Saturday. It was a Catholic ceremony, a Catholic service. So I think several papers, letter pages are filled with some Catholics questioning how the Prime Minister was able to have the ceremony, given his previous marriages. There are several theories to that. But the wedding took place, and then there was a reception, we believe, of 30 people, so within the rules, in Downing Street. Some questions over whether they should have used a marquee not paid for by themselves, apparently used for functions. That's one of the debates going onwards. I was personally intrigued that there's reports of dancing at the wedding in the garden, because last time I checked, perhaps because I've been reading wedding guidance quite closely, you're not actually allowed to dance at weddings, but I think maybe you're just not allowed a dance floor, whereas dancing randomly is okay. So I think there's probably some wriggle room for the happy couple there. But generally speaking, I suppose politically, what does this change? I think it is interesting in the sense that we've all seen, and you know, I've reported on the feuding in Downing Street, and we had Dominic Cummings' evidence last week. There was factional warfare on many levels, but it is true that Carrie Simmons has been a part of that. Vote Leave did not get on with her near the end of this. We even had a briefing in the Times, apparently from friends of Carrie Simmons, so you have to wonder, saying that her wedding is a triumph over Dominic Cummings. So I think, like, there was a question as to, does the fact she now has a formal role, she is formally Boris Johnson's wife, mean that we're going to have fewer issues in terms of what this person is doing behind the scenes? Because I think now that person can be more public facing. So when you have things like G7, because of the formalization of her position as his partner, as his wife, I think you can start to see how that person could build more of a public role. And if that is done in the right way, it could actually ease some of the questions over what she's doing behind the scenes.
Yes, because Dominic Cummings did make quite a point of saying at his hearing last week, referring to her as the girlfriend rather than the fiance or anything else quite a few times. And James, tonight we're also going to be getting Keir Starmer in a tell-all interview with Piers Morgan. I mean, he's not quite a Meghan Markle type to tell-all. What are we actually expecting to find out about the Labour leader?
I think this is the Labour leader deciding that he has to take some more risks to raise his public profile and to kind of earn some more likability points with the public. In his first year as Labour leader, Keir Starmer was essentially relying on government mistakes, and that did work out for him quite well. I mean, I think we do forget that at the beginning of this year, Labour were often level or ahead in the polls. The problem for him is that the vaccine rollout has kind of shifted the narrative about the government and competence, and has kind of left Keir Starmer with very little to say. And obviously, bad election results have kind of put the pressure on him. So I think what he's trying to do is take some more risks and see if that can persuade the public to see a different side of him. I think these things generally don't have as much impact as you might expect. I think that, you know, this interview will be, you know, a classic Piers Morgan interview. But I would be surprised if it kind of changed on its own, changed how people perceived Keir Starmer.
Katie, is this a good idea? Because we know from recent history, like Jo Swinson, you know, there are some political leaders where the more you hear, the less you want to hear of them. Keir Starmer might be someone like that. I mean, he doesn't strike me as very interesting.
But perhaps, Cindy, this is the genius of the plan. Lots of people do think Keir Starmer is quite dull. So it could confirm this view. Or perhaps he just needs to be a little bit interesting and it will pleasantly surprise a lot of people. I think it's an interesting one. I think that there's some talk also of this through the keyhole, fly on the wall documentary. I think that's way more risky than doing this sit down long interview. Let's see what it brings. As James says, I don't get the impression it's going to hugely change the dial, but I think there is an issue with Keir Starmer in the sense there is just this growing accepted view of him as almost being a slightly quiet, personality-free leader. And that means it's very hard for him to cut through unless the Tories have a disaster. So if he can do anything to kind of suggest he has a sense of humour or he has something that makes him stand out, he doesn't have to try and be Boris Johnson. But, you know, something about him that resonates, and I think that probably is going to be a good thing.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And thanks for listening to this episode of Coffee House Shots. If you enjoyed it, do rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from, and join us again tomorrow.